This is a Partially Examined Life, episode 395, part two. We've been discussing C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. Did you know that his name is Clive Staples Lewis? Had you heard that before?
Never once.
Is it at the end of the book?
It's in the About the Author, yes.
Yeah, in the About the Author. That's the first place I think I'd seen it before, but I'd forgotten. So yeah, Staples.
I don't know which of those names I find more alarming.
What a middle name.
Hey, Clive.
Staples.
Yes.
I mean, it's so, I think CS is a big improvement.
Yeah, we now know why it's CS.
So we're going to get to the ethics here before too long. That's chapter three. And chapter four is sort of theory of personality, the theory of the self and the telos behind the ethics, right? But I think we still have a little more of book two to go, you know, what Christians believe. So how do we get all the way snared in so that we care about what Christian ethics has to say about communism and chastity and things like that? Yes. Was there any more from book two here that we quotes you wanted to read?
Well, I wanted to say a little bit more about the invasion the shocking alternative.
Yeah.
Chapter three. It's more about chapter four for me. But so there's a bit of theodicy in chapter three, very typical theodicy about why there's evil in the world. And it's necessary because we have free will and otherwise we'd be automaton. There'd be no basis for love and joy and all the good things.
Yeah. A weird approach to that. The problem of evil, you might be driven to some sort of nihilism by the fact that it seems if you just observe the world, it does not tend toward goodness and things working out. It tends toward decay. There's so much suffering. But the fact that you are asking that question means that there is this, again, non-natural, not empirically detectable, but right there in within you, sense of right and wrong. So however bad the world is, doesn't even matter to this supernatural sense that you have that it can be judged at all.
I think the most interesting part of this, for me, this chapter, Mark, you had mentioned God's response to this misery is conscience and good dreams, which is the pagan myths of the dying and rising God. I think that's the part you mentioned, Mark. Chosen people. And then finally, the Jesus as someone who's not just a great moral teacher. That's just kind of lame. But really, the significant thing is that he claims that he can forgive our sins. Forgive all sins, right? So even if someone has wronged me, and which makes you think, is this guy a lunatic? And what is he talking about? You wronged me. You owe me. I want my pound of flesh. Who is this Jesus saying that you're forgiven? No, you owe me. So anyway, so it is weird. And he'll get into the significance of that in the next chapter. But I thought the interesting part here was this idea of that the root of human misery is trying to find happiness apart from God. So we already talked a little bit about the misery of the internal tension of moral commandments that we can't ever really fully fulfill. But this to me is the more significant part. So this is on page 49, where he says, how did the, so I think this is the thing we really all want an explanation of. Why would God let Satan into the world, right? All right, page 49. How did the dark power go wrong? Because he used to be an angel. Here, no doubt, we ask a question to which human beings cannot give an answer with any certainty. A reasonable and traditional guess, based on our own experiences of going wrong, can, however, be offered. The moment you have a self at all, there is a possibility of putting yourself first, wanting to be the center, wanting to be God, in fact. That was the sin of Satan, and that was the sin he taught the human race. Some people think the fall of man had something to do with sex, but that is a mistake. The story in the book of Genesis rather suggests that some corruption in our sexual nature followed the fall and was its result, not its cause. What Satan put into the heads of our remote ancestors was the idea that they could be like gods, could set up on their own as if they had created themselves, be their own masters, invent some sort of happiness for themselves outside God, apart from God. And out of that hopeless attempt has come nearly all that we call human history: money, poverty, ambition, war, prostitution, classes, empires, slavery, a long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God, which will make him happy. Now, I think that, yeah, so that for me is, again, the very psychologically appealing part, this idea that central origin of human misery is this focus, and it's often unconscious, but this focus on being a god or being completely autonomous, escaping all dependency, and it often, right, manifests itself in people's ambitions when it's actually surrender. And, you know, you could, for those of us who are more secular, we'd have to take the god part out of this, but there's some kind of surrender that's necessary in order to actually find happiness.
What part in the Christian narrative do you think he's appealing to here? Because initially in my head, I was trying to make the connection between pride and the fall, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I don't know that I can make that super tight, but is there not being, that's still part of the book that I grew up with too. But what, is there something else that you think he's pointing to as far as Satan and pride and all that, that as part of the Christian story?
Well, to me, it resonates with the part of the Christian story that is the weak shall inherit the earth, the meek shall inherit the earth. The very part that someone like Nietzsche finds so abhorrent, which is basically people who haven't, who have the most common experience is the experience of the world running over you, whether it be other people or nature or misfortune. And that it's, that also becomes another sign that God exists and that there is a saving grace from that. And maybe the extra Christian twist that he's appealing to at the beginning is the notion that we're culpable for our own misfortune in some important ways and that we can get relief from that.
I mean, to me, this is, it is all about pride, Seth, to speak to your point. Do you remember when Tomasello was on, or no, well, he was on, but I guess it was in a video where he thinks that people's psychological ailments are quote unquote thumotic ailments. He was kind of into thumos too, because it's a natural kind of adjunct to joint attention, which is at the basis of language and at the basis of morality and to our concept of recognition, right? And I also associated to this, the superego and our capacity for identification, which builds the superego. But basically, you know, once we get invested in how others see us, which is part of the reactive demands, right, that he talked about as the basis of morality. So once we start making demands on people's recognition, we can get really out of joint, right? We could spend our lives trying to seek admiration or power, which is partly about prestige and partly about how we affect other psyches. So I think the idea here is that the pride means that we, you know, we act as if all these things, money and sex and pleasure and power, are the essence of things. Although I think it really all is, Nietzsche's right in a sense that it all really comes down to power. And so this is as old as Plato, right? This is in fact not the Plato and Aristotle. It's not the key to happiness. We are mistaken about that. And you can do virtue ethics. You can Plato or Aristotle if you think that's going to get you out of that point of view. You can do some therapy, do some psychoanalysis. And the analog there is in this idea of moving away from primitive defense mechanisms like splitting, where everything is all good or all bad, or paranoia, to what the psychoanalyst Melanie Klein called the depressive position, where you sort of mourn the loss of an ideal self and an ideal object to whom you can relate by way of that self, right? Or an ideal audience. You win, right? At the center of kind of narcissistic ambition is winning over a perfect other by virtue of becoming a perfect self. So it's that quest that has to be given up. And so you might think, well, that has to be done therapeutically. And I think it can't just be done through rationality. And psychoanalysis has its own claims on that therapeutic idea. But here, what he's saying is that this can only be done by God modeling that sacrifice for himself. God has got to show us how to give that up. And there's something, to me, it seems that there's something like inherently therapeutic in his idea of what it means to accept Christ dying on the cross for us as a model of giving up pride and giving up ambition and giving up all these false ideals.
Yeah, it's the therapy or the modeling via what would Jesus do kind of thing.
But not even just intellectually, it is literally letting Jesus do the thing through you. And if you don't know what that is, well, imitatu de Christe, yes. So you do put on Jesus as a costume as he describes in book four. And then that lets you, you know, it's really Jesus, in fact, putting on Jesus's own costume, because Jesus is acting through you. God is acting through you in reaching toward God, using this mechanism that is basically also God. So this is the Trinity.
This attachment to our own omnipotence, like, which I think is a real psychological phenomenon. It's often very subtle, which is, and you can understand it theoretically long before you get it at any gut level, or long before you think you've maybe made some progress in giving it up if you have a problem with it, which I think most of us do. So you can't just think about it rationally. There has to be something therapeutic that's going on, some sort of deep rehabituation of the human psyche. And so I think whatever... So faith, I think, for C.S. Lewis must involve that, and faith in particular in the death and resurrection as a, it's not just a metaphor, it's something historical, but it's also, it's an image of what happens to us psychologically when we embrace the historical fact.
We pointed out that, you know, it goes back as far as Plato and Aristotle, but I think that this notion of the self being a problem and part of getting flourishing in the world is going to involves some right relation of the self that involves diminishing the self with respect to the world. It seems very, very common. I mean, you have Buddhism, right? You have the not self, right? And so that somehow that ourselves get in the way of having a successful flourishing of the self is, I'll call it, just a recognized problem. There are different solutions to that and different theoretical underpinnings for why it is a problem. But it seems very extraordinarily common, actually, that is. And even in the Western tradition, Stoicism is directly related to this observation.
I think the difference with Christianity and monotheistic religion is that it takes that omnipotent part of the self and it tries to put it outside of us. And not just put it in the state as a nationalist might, or put it in the nation as a nationalist might, or put it in the state or something outside of us where it's still a threat in a way. If we can put it in something all good and all dependable, or maybe just outside of the universe, let's just get it out. Let's just get it out of here entirely. It ceases to be as threatening. So it becomes almost like a lightning rod for our own overweening tendencies, our own, again, this tendency towards thinking of ourselves as omnipotent. So if we can locate it outside of us and then be in a position of subservience in relation to it, then we might be cured. And then the question is, well, how do you do that if you don't buy this particular religious principle? Is there another way to do that? And, you know, a secular version of that makes sense.
Right. So it does increasingly throughout this become like a self-help text, like that the people who really like Stoicism or, you know, just in general, the therapy of desire, the different things that Nussbaum talks about that in that book, whether it's Aristotelian conditioning and modifying your emotional reactions to make them appropriate or, yeah, any of the other variations of the ancient wisdom traditions, I feel like, yeah, you're going to get actually something similar out of that. You're going to get similar exercises. You want to do daily prayer to remind yourself of what you believe. And I don't like it in the same way that I've objected to Stoicism. A modern Christian reading this could say, I'm overwriting the operating system of my brain. The passions that we are given by nature are faulty and self-destructive. We need to just completely just rip them out, not work toward that, you know, the overall telos that the original animal is working toward. That is not us. We want to just become of a different type of person with a different type of post-human telos.
Not the passions, right? Not instincts towards sex and pleasure, but power and recognition. All the stuff that sits on top of self-consciousness. I think that's important to this type of picture. You don't locate the problem in the instinctual. You locate it in this a higher things that human beings that other animals don't, mutual recognition, superego, thumos, pride, power, et cetera, et cetera.
But it is Mark's making a good distinction. Like in someone like Plato and Aristotle, you would recognize your thematic tendencies as just being part of who you are. And so there's this question of what ought to be controlling what. And someone like Aristotle would say, to be a full human being, you need to have this right relationship between the various parts of your soul. And that's the proper activity for us teleologically to become who we really are. And that's the kind of language you would use. But here, it's that we need to recognize that who we are has its source outside of us. And that what we need to do is in fact, he uses this language, we need to kill part of ourselves in order to become the God that we ought to be. So the distinction of
the sons of God.
Well, the sons of God, but the Son of God, of course, is God, right? And so there is a way in which the humility that is supposed to be present is a subjugation of ourselves, that recognition. Okay, so there's that pride. But the thing that's held out in a funny way is actually the doubling down on our godlike ambitions. Okay, not in the sense of being God as being all controlling and all powerful, but as godlike as possible. So,
well, the project of becoming perfect, which we always fail at, but he doesn't want us to give up.
You know? Yes.
And it seems there's no room for creativity here, right? Perfection is always an external, static thing that we are trying to mold ourselves to. Yes, once we are fully Christian, then we become fully individual. And you would think then, well, then I will be in the position to be so wise that I'll be able to morally innovate. There's no real discussion of that stage other than there's a lightness. Like once you reach the other side, you know, Christians will recognize each other, which is very much unlike Kierkegaard, right? I'm going to follow this personal calling and jump to a place that even the other people who are saved, you know, who make a similar leap, I will not be able to understand them and they will not be able to understand me because we are radically different. But he's like, you know, at the very least, being one of them, these select who has become newly born, newly living with my new personality through Christ, it's going to be tremendously fun. It's going to be, he says, that I'll recognize other people in this secret society. So I feel like there is a gay science kind of quality to it that once you set down these things that are weighing you down, you will have this enormous lightness, right? One of the chapters we read is Christianity easy or hard? And like, well, it's both, because giving up that sense of your initial self, the thing that you are seeking power for, is very, very difficult. And you have to keep doing it every day. But there is a sense of lightness once you get to the other side.
He has this great image of us, which really resonated with me, of getting up in the morning and having all of our desires rush at us like animals. Do you remember that? Let's see. It comes the very moment you wake up each morning. All your wishes and hopes for the day rush at you like wild animals. I love that. And the first job each morning consists simply in shoving them all back and listening to that other voice, taking that other point of view, letting that other larger, stronger, quieter life come flowing in, and so on all day, standing back from all your natural fussings and frettings, coming in and out of the wind. And of course, you know, I think people approach this through Buddhism, other faith traditions. It's a, you know, similar ideas, but yeah.
Well, I think Lewis's conception here differs to some extent from, you know, the other three that you mentioned, Buddhism, Stoicism, and I guess you could talk about the Kierkegaardian approach, because those are essentially individualistic. And I think that's actually a weakness of those particular ideologies, wisdom traditions, strategies for transcendence or enlightenment, whatever. And I want to go back to what I said, that Lewis here, even though he's talking about essentially what the effects on the individual are, that it's critical for him that there be this aspect of, let's just call it Royceian community, where the sacrifice, right, is a, I want to say subjugation, that's not the right word, but, you know, it's a colonization.
Integration.
An integration that you give up yourself, you sacrifice yourself, and God comes into you, but God is coming into other beings as well, and you essentially become a community with those others, and the effects it might have would be to give you
a secret society of,
it's a secret society of happy people, right? And you recognize, like later on, he talks about, you know, maybe wise and happy people just can recognize each other, and you may not be able to see them, not even know you're talking to one. And then, you know, the idea is, of course, that you need the secret society to build up enough members so that when the troops land, right, there can be a counter, there can be an uprising. So anyway, I mentioned that only because, you know, Wes, you were talking about the problem with self-consciousness, us externalizing it into this all good thing, and that it's, you know, somehow bridging the gap between ourselves and this transcendent all good other is the way we get back, or the way we erase that problem with thematic element of ourselves. And it's exactly that move that I think ultimately sort of dooms the project, because that totalizing and universalizing and absolutizing of the self in this, you know, in this other is what's going to create the structure for the kind of things that aren't communitarian, that aren't respectful and happy and joyous. But like I said, I like this approach at least because it tries to retain some aspect of that as opposed to some of the more individualistic responses.
Yeah, I mean, he himself admits, right, all of this can be entirely corrupted to the very ends that it's supposedly opposing, right? You can have a church, which is very much, right, a Catholic church through the centuries, which is very much all about power, including political power and lots of violence and all the sorts of things that they should have done away with, or priests who, and popes who are full of vanity and ambition and haven't given up that part of themselves at all, and even are using the church to further all of that and foster that in people. It can all be completely corrupt, unfortunately. So even this project of giving up the omnipotent part of ourselves, let's just put it that way, can just be completely co-opted by the omnipotent part of ourselves. And we don't even know it often. Happens at a personal level, and certainly happens at a, you know, world historical and political level.
So I feel like we've really transitioned into book three, Christian behavior, of what morality consists in. And, you know, I had characterized this earlier that, okay, once you've accepted the existential situation as the Christian defines it, then you're going to just surrender your judgment. But that's not actually how he presents it, at least to start off in book three here. It is supposed to be something that is empirically verifiable. It is a science of living, right? Just like Stoicism is supposedly, like, the Stoics have tried all these things, and what are different ways of coping according to our principles? And okay, here's my latest strategy. That Christianity is supposed to be like that as well. And so when we get into like sexual morality, well, if you just obey what your instincts tell you, it will be very evidently self-destructive. Right? Because a healthy young man will want to fuck everything. And no, we have to restrain it somehow. It doesn't mean that, you know, he's going to give a further defense of like either complete monogamy in marriage or nothing. No masturbation. No, like, he's going to give a further defense of that. But just the fact that defense is...
Does he mention masturbation?
Yes.
Oh, he does? Okay. I know he said complete abstinence. I didn't realize
he does later. Specifically about like people who have certain problems, like that they're ashamed of their masturbation or something. Like, that's the only time he explicitly references. But when he brings it up in this initial, in chapter five here, when he's talking about, you know, you could just keep failing and then you just try again the next day. So he doesn't like really say, you know, masturbation will make you go blind or something like that. But certainly, like, there has to be some sort of controls on instincts. So it's just a matter of like, where are you going to get your standard of rationality for the controls, right? If you are merely hygienic is one of the options he gives, then you would have certain controls, right? I don't want to just have sex with anybody because I don't want to get VD. I don't want to break people's hearts. I don't want my heart to be broken. I don't want to get people pregnant. You know, there's lots of reasons to restrict yourself, but none of those are like, and that's why I should never masturbate. In fact, probably you should masturbate because you're going to avoid all these more destructive things. But it ends up being like, well, by showing that you have the mastery over your will and your body, you're making yourself into the kind of soldier for God. You're making yourself into the kind of person that God approves of.
The thing that was most interesting to me in chapter five is this idea of a sexual instinct gone wrong and being disordered and out of proportion to biological function. And he gives that great analogy to the striptease. You know, what if we are all going to clubs and sitting and watching people gradually undress a piece of food, you know? Getting off on that, we would think that something's gone wrong in society. He claims not to be anti-sex and anti-body, and he claims that Christianity is not that, right? It doesn't think that the body or that sex is bad. But he also doesn't really explain the problem with promiscuity. I think he just thinks in perversity. He just thinks that we will naturally agree with him that such things are problematic and ought to be held in check. But I think that the unique thing here is the idea that, I mean, he does say, yes, if men left their own devices, would want to have as much sex as possible with as many women as possible. He does say that. But then he also suggests that it's not that the disorder of the sexual instinct is, it's not that people are starving, but that they're overindulged in a way and they're subject to quote unquote lust propaganda and to people saying, oh, if you don't want to have lots of sex, you're repressed or something like that, to sort of peer pressure.
Well, it's not just peer pressure. It's that he does continue the analogy with food. Like, it's that our sexual appetites are disordered because of that disorder is fed and heightened by our environment, as if we were always going to a gluttonous meal at a restaurant all the time. You know, if we're always around all kinds of food that is unhealthy for us to eat in large quantities, then, well, of course, we'll get so that we have a disordered relationship with food. That's basically what he's saying. And so he's saying that this relationship, this distorted relationship we have with our sexuality is made much, much harder because of our culture. It's a cultural criticism, and that we don't recognize the ways in which we're just being manipulated by people who want to make money, and that fact is causing us further problems. And we, in fact, buy into the rhetoric that I think he would say it's the same thing for the cigarette manufacturers and alcohol and AI, it's basically, a kind of Marxian cultural criticism that people are just trying to make money off of us and they're manipulating us in that way. And that is most prominent with sex.
And now a word from our sponsor, Function. With the World Cup final happening this month, I keep thinking about one thing. Every player on that pitch has a whole team behind them tracking everything about their health. Biomarkers, recovery, sleep, all of it dialed in. And look, I'm not playing for a national team, but that doesn't mean I don't deserve that same level of care. Here's the thing about elite athletes. They don't guess about their health. They measure it. And honestly, our lives ask a lot of us too. Whether that's chasing a personal best, getting up before sunrise to train, or just keeping up with your kids or your grandkids. The pros treat their bodies like the asset they are, and I wanted the same kind of insight without needing to be a pro. That's why I use Function. We're talking 160 plus lab tests a year, the kind of full body picture athletes pay a fortune for. Not guessing, just knowing exactly where you stand so you can show up as your best today and every day after. So check your health the way I do. Function gives over 160 lab tests for $1 a day, plus member pricing on advanced imaging. Join at functionhealth.com/PEL and use code PEL25 for a $25 credit. That's functionhealth.com/PEL, code PEL25.
Let's speak again about Shopify. Do some phenomenology with me. You are empirically doing some things, but yet you have a vision, a non-empirical notion that you should be doing something in addition, something else. It's that business idea. Maybe your own podcast you want to start. I don't know the exact contents of your mind, but I bet there's something you've been sitting on, and for one reason or another, you're not doing it yet. Well, Shopify makes it easy to make it happen. Everything you need to start selling is included and ready from day one, right? They'll set you up with your store, and when your first customer is ready to pay, Shopify checkout helps more of them finish their purchase. When they come back, their details are already saved, one tap and they're done. That's the biggest barrier, getting paid, because Shopify handles the setup, the checkout. You can put your energies into growing the business, and Shopify gives you the tools to do that, right? Add another podcast. That's what I did. Get your product, your art, to more people. Diversify the kind of stuff you're producing. With Shopify, nothing stands between your idea and a real business, so go make one. Start your free trial at shopify.com/PEL. That's shopify.com/PEL, shopify.com/PEL. Well, I really like this, because usually the response to Marxist sort of propaganda argument is, no, we need to figure out authenticity. But sort of following Hegel's, right, we introduced the notion of spirit by saying, look, all this thing you think, oh, that's my real self. These are my real political opinions. No, this is, you're regurgitating things that you have been spoon-fed, largely propaganda. So a lot of even what you consider your gut instinct tells you to do that is coming from a dirty well. So you really, there is no way to clean up the well and just like get rid of the propaganda and figure out, what do you really think? What do you really want? You just have to throw the whole thing out and replace it with Christ's instincts, which of course, you know, there has to be something in you that is receptive of that. So in a sense, you could still say, well, you know, what you really want, your real personality is going to say is, you know, what you get when you get this out of the way. But it has to at least have the phenomenological character and the ontological character of something foreign, removing the natural self, throwing it away. Then so you get this, the second nature. We've talked about that before, of like you got your natural and then you, society is the second nature. Well, in this case, society is part of the junk that has corrupted your first nature. Maybe if we didn't have the whole anti-God society that, you know, the society that has drifted so far from God's words, then we would be able to trust ourselves. We would be like the lilies of the field who just can naturally flourish. But we're so bad that we just need to start fresh.
Does he use the phrase to be born again? I mean,
I think so.
I never saw that phrase myself, but the parts that I read, he used all the language that walks you up to that.
He quotes it on 191. He says, you know, that the New Testament talks about Christians being born again. I don't think he himself. So, I mean, if we look at, I mean, the strongest statement of something like that is just if we go back to book 3, chapter 4, The Perfect Penitent, where he's describing, right, we get some of the, right. So laying down your arms, surrendering, saying you are sorry, realizing this is 56, realizing that you have been on the wrong track and getting ready to start life over again from the ground floor. Right. That's a kind of reborn idea there. That is the only way out of our hole, quote unquote. The process of surrender, this movement full speed astern, is what Christians call repentance. And then repentance is no fun, right? Because it means unlearning all the self-conceit and self-will that we have been training ourselves into for thousands of years. It means killing part of yourself, undergoing a kind of death. And then implicitly later on, you know, he'll say, we can't do that for ourselves. And so God has to do that for us. We cannot share, this is on page 58, we cannot share God's dying unless God dies. And he cannot die except by being a man. That is in the sense in which he pays our debt and suffers for us what he himself need not suffer at all. Okay, so I thought I was going to see something there about the Christ's resurrection being our resurrection. It seems implicit, but yeah, he's not. I don't remember him explicitly talking a lot about being reborn.
Well, we're becoming new men, right, is ultimately what.
In chapter 5. Yeah, maybe chapter 5 men. Is where it's at. Yeah, right? That's where this is the Christian alternative to the Superman.
Another place where he references, like, clearly he's never read any Nietzsche, he's never read any Hegel, but he'll occasionally throw in what was apparently like the common understanding of those philosophers in his time. So like people have thought about what the next stage of human evolution would be, like the Superman, the Übermensch, and they only imagine something that is rather nastier than we are now, right? That someone who's thrown away their conscience, their notions of good and evil, and maybe is, you know, murdering people because they think they're so much superior to the sheep that they're murdering. Yeah. So, you know, the state of Nietzsche's scholarship in his age. I do think, right. So I mentioned Hegel, who also Lewis mentions just as a pantheist, right? You could either think that God wants good things and is on the side of good, or you could just think, well, God is equivalent to the whole universe. So all the good and the evil, they're all just sort of relative. And Hegel is definitely so it'd be interesting to sort of see to what extent we agree with that. But certainly we know that for Hegel, there was a directionality to history and to the growth of spirit. And it's not just like, oh, spirit just is. Like, that's the kind of Spinozism that Hegel condemns a little bit. But we do have the idea that when you become, you know, you transcend your individuality to become a spirit, and ultimately it's going to be in, you know, a Christian commune kind of thing. And so I think some of the things that we found so weird about Hegel's notion of Christianity is actually just the weirdness of Christianity, right? That's what we're seeing here, is get rid of the brain that you were born with and insert the Borg, Christian Borg brain that will, you'll still be an individual, don't worry, but we'll all be working in tandem like the spokes of a wheel. We will be perfectly integrated.
Yeah, I think there's something here in common with Hegel's faith and knowledge, where he doesn't just want the abstract deism, the soft religion that, you know, is what C.S. Lewis would call it, of a Kant.
Yep.
We want the particulars, we want the images, the Christ's resurrection and that whole experience, and that experiences, which may involve something like intellectual intuition or aesthetic intuition or a combination of all that, right, that allows us to know God, that experience is specific to the weirdness of Christianity and to these particular historical doctrines. Although Hegel does say at another point that the historical doctrine is not the point, but anyway, in the phenomenology, it's complicated, but yeah, I do see some commonality.
Yeah, I think, but Lewis doesn't want to admit the commonality. At least he brings up Hegel earlier when talking about, I guess it's in book two, what different conceptions of...
He says he's a pantheist, which I don't think, to be fair to him, I don't think that's entirely wrong, right? Hegel was a big fan of Spinoza, and there's a huge, I mean, the pantheism controversy, I think that got Fichte fired, right? These people were all thought of as subscribing to Spinozan pantheism.
Yep.
I mean, one cannot, given how much difficulty we've had in getting handle on Hegel, with all the secondary sources we have available to us, I do not blame Lewis, who, you know, was a literature professor and not the deepest reader of Royce and Bradley, F.H. Bradley. So I'm sure there was some popular cachet, but yeah, who can blame C.S. Lewis for not seeing the underlying similarities in that some of what, you know, Hegel was in talking about the spirit and spirit, he's talking about the Holy Ghost. So, you know, C.S. Lewis is just going to talk about the Holy Ghost just explicitly. He's not trying to secularize anything. I guess let's look more about this. Yeah, the model of virtue and how we know what we're supposed to do.
Well, okay.
Yeah, because it seems like even though the whole thing started with you have a conscience.
We should also get to the theology a little bit before we end the last.
Okay.
But yeah, is this something from chapter book three that you're still...
I was trying to figure out if there was, right, you started out with your conscience. That's how we got in the Christian position in the first place. But it seems after a while you have to abandon your personal conscience because now you're using Jesus's conscience. So you are acting on authority. He doesn't specifically say, why do we have to have faith in the Bible? But he does say in some places like, well, of course, God explains himself better than we ever could. So, you know, here in this book, I'm kind of just I'm speculating about something. But let's look back to the gospel word by word, the fact that Jesus says only in John, only the book written 100 years after his death, he says, I am God. Like, so that's, you know, brings the whole dreaded possibility.
Well, we didn't read in this book, you know, we didn't read the chapter on the cardinal virtues, which are just, right, straight out of ancient Greek virtue ethics. And then there's also the chapter 8 on pride as sort of being the root sin of everything, self-conceit. And I think we've kind of talked enough about that today. Yeah. So maybe the question you're asking, Mark, is, yeah, what's the connection between our conscience and moral dictates and Christianity specifically? And maybe, you know, if there's an answer to that, it has something to do with the focus on pride and the giving up of pride and the use of the God's self-sacrifice for that. But otherwise, we might say, well, you know, yeah, all of these virtues, what's so specifically Christian about that? Other than maybe he gets to charity and faith. But is that the question? What's specifically Christian about this morality?
Well, he brings up in the first chapter of book three here, right? How does a human machine go wrong? We could individuals drift apart from each other or collide with each other doing damage, or there could be something wrong with the individual. So it sounds, you know, this again, as you're saying, sounds just very ancient Greek, like, you know, put your house in order, make yourself a balanced person as Plato might recommend. But then there is beyond that, the goal of humanity's voyage. Right. So he uses these different analogies of like, it's like we're all instruments. Well, each instrument has to be in tune, but then they all have to be, you know, playing together in an orchestra, and they have to come in the right places. So, but what is this actually aiming at? And that is something that is, this I think is the profound difference between it and merely rational virtue ethics in Aristotle, that Aristotle looks at what is the human machine. How can we make the human machine govern itself most intelligently? And it will be self-evident to us whether things are working out or not. And C.S. Lewis follows that to a certain degree, but ultimately we do not own the machine. The machine does not set its own goals. It does not contain its own telos. The telos is given by the maker who created it in such a way that it is in fact liable to go wrong because it has free will. It has these things that will ultimately give it greater potential, but are not, we were not fine-tuned to aim right at the virtuous.
He's all about flourishing, right? So, you know, he gives the whole ship's analogy, right? And so we don't want the ships to bump into each other, and then the ships have to be working. And then there's the question of the goal of the voyage and where the ships are headed, where the ships. And he thinks modern morality focuses too much on the ships just not colliding, right? So the whole harm principle, I can do what I want as long as I'm not harming others. And he wants to emphasize more, right, the virtue ethics of it, the you know, how the ships are doing, and then the ultimate goal. And I think the way those two things are connected is that flourishing for him, unlike for Aristotle, involves faith and this connection to religion specifically. I'm trying to find the place where he says that. So, yeah.
There's a decent representation of that on page 156. If Christianity only means one more bit of good advice, then Christianity is no importance. There's been no lack of good advice for the last 4,000 years. A bit more makes no difference. But as soon as you look at any real Christian writings, you find they're talking about something quite different from this popular religion, you know, the modern do no harm thing. They say that Christ is the Son of God, whatever that means. They say that those who give him their confidence can also become sons of God, whatever that means. They say that his death saved us from our sins, whatever that means. Which is basically just saying, this isn't really ultimately about morality, because you can get the same good advice somewhere else. There's a part, I don't think I made a note of it, but I remember reading it, where he sort of makes the connection to, he's talking about eternal life, the idea that being, accepting Christ is moving from the realm of the finite to the infinite, so to speak, or the, you know, the time bound to the eternal. And that ultimately it's that transition. And at the end of the book, he talks about evolution and transitions and all that sort of thing. But that's ultimately what's at stake.
Yeah. Yes. Let's talk about these
books. A lot of the counterintuitive ethical stuff comes out of that, that you might think that a mass murderer is a much worse person than somebody who just has some nasty thoughts about something. But he talks about, well, if you have nasty thoughts, these make you into a different person over time. And so you could just become the kind of person who is fundamentally going to resist Christ's influence. And so as you know, someone who is not capable of experiencing heaven, whereas the mass murderer, like, well, that might, you know, all the things that happen on the mortal plane are really just a blip compared to eternity. So presumably there's things also going on in the mass murderer's head, but it's not obvious that the mass murderer is so much worse than merely, you know, somebody who masturbates or has bad thoughts or something like that.
All right. That's a particular quibble. With
that just sounds stupid.
But the overall gist of this, right, I think Seth was on to, right, this idea of transformation. He compares this to evolution, and this is also where he is sort of the allusion to the Superman, but it's not, so there, it's something like a mutation leading to adaptation, but it's a different in kind. This is why he objects to the Superman. The Superman is just a brainier or stronger, or, you know, maybe for Nietzsche, a gayer and more integrated with the aesthetic and the scientific, you know, version of us. But for him, it's a completely, it's a difference in kind because we change to being sons of God, as he puts it. And it's also not produced by sexual reproduction, but it's voluntary. We make this decision to do this. And that, you know, this is where we get the image of these new men. He says the step has already happened, right? It's not like we're waiting on this. It's already happened. And there are men scattered over the earth who form the secret society of happier people. And then finally, the suggestion in this chapter is that this is the only way to become ourselves, to surrender to Christ, because until we do that, we are entirely heteronymous. We are just our natural selves. We are just at the mercy of our instincts and our determining circumstances, our essence, our character. This is a little bit existentialist here. How do we go beyond being merely empirical, natural creatures who are driven by our inclinations and our circumstances. Well, one philosophical picture says, well, we have free will and we transcend that. And here the picture is that there must be some kind of surrender to something else in order to escape submission to our empirical, physical sides.
I have to say there is something, again, talking about his rhetorical flourish, and he's using the analogy to evolution, or talking about evolution. He says, this is on page 219, thousands of centuries ago, there were huge, very heavily armored creatures that evolved. And if anybody had been watching the course of evolution, probably would have expected that it was just going to keep going heavier and heavier with more armor. But he would have been wrong. The future had a card up its sleeve, sprung on him a little naked, unarmed animal that had better brains, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, this is not, as you said, Wes, it's not only a different step, but a different step of a different kind. The stream of evolution took a sharp bend. Now, I'm not sure that holds entirely, because we don't go directly from dinosaurs to apes. There was a little bit that happened in between, I think, but...
Well, he's saying that the mammals started dominating over the dinosaurs.
Okay, but there was also supposedly some kind of catastrophic event. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
It's just an analogy.
I'm going to defend the dinosaurs here. It's not that the mammals were better.
But then he does say, he says that, anybody who's making a guess about what the next step of human, existence is going to be like, or evolution, are probably making the same mistakes. They think we're going to get bigger brains, right? And more mastery over nature. They think because the stream is flowing that way, it'll continue to flow that way. And he says, I think it's going to go off in a direction we could never have dreamed of, and it wouldn't be worth calling a new step unless it did. I don't think it will just be a difference, but a new kind of difference. In fact, I said the next stage in evolution will not be a stage in evolution at all. It will supersede evolution itself as a method.
And it's already happened.
And it's already happened. And that's what... And
Christ is the first instance of the new.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And we're in the early stages of it.
His only instance of technical terminology that he introduces here is two different Greek words for life. Bios, biological life. It inevitably runs down, but Zoe, spiritual life, is eternal. A man who changed from bios to Zoe would be like changing from carved stone to real man. It's page 159.
Yeah, so we are sort of like imperfect images of God, like statues, just as statues are to human beings. And so becoming ourselves and our fully alive, spiritually alive, is like kind of like a statue coming to life on this analogy. What does it mean exactly? It is vague, right? We become more ourselves. We find our real selves. We are more unlike than alike, right? In our imitation of Christ, our uniqueness comes out more. We don't just become pale imitations of Christ and each other. But, I guess maybe the upshot is just, you're happy if you do this. You're one of these happy few men in the secret society who, I guess, has conquered pride. Is that the...
Well, but you have to keep doing it every day. So there's sort of a contradiction there that on the one hand, no, you're transformed to a new person, but he also is, he's keenly, his moral psychology is not bad in throughout this, that he definitely dislikes the same people that Nietzsche dislikes, right? If you're really a despiser of life, if you are using your power, your priestly class to lord yourself over others, I think there's a lot of commonality such that, I don't know, I really want this to be falsifiable in the Popperian sense, that there could be some, because is it really the case that these people, now we're the blessed? Like, when you look at them more closely, they're still just as miserable as everybody else, right? They just fool themselves some of the time. It's just a story they're telling themselves. And I want something like midichlorians or something. If you're going to say that the force is with you, I want a fucking biological way to measure that. Even just, your brain chemistry. We've done, like, the people, we've had, Buddhists on, hey, if you do Buddhist meditation, we can neurologically measure you, and like your brain chemistry have changed. You are objectively a more peaceful person. I want that kind of evidence from
It's called Christian. Scientology, Mark. There are instruments that can tell you whether you're clear.
Yes, instruments that the...
Have you reached Tom Cruise level?
Instruments that yet? The cult has invented and regulates. No, I want pre-existing instruments.
I'm fairly certain that they've done that sort of thing with like Buddhist monks, where they measure normal brain activity and then measure meditative state or whatever it is.
I think we've had guests on that have told us about that, yes.
But, you know, of course, all that does is show that the practice of meditation changes the mental state. It doesn't actually tell you that the meditative mental state is somehow qualitatively better in a way that makes sense, scientific sense or something like that. But I mean, I think we have to ask ourselves, right? So we started out the book, he starts out saying, there's a moral something going on and it gives me a conscience. And ultimately that conscience leads to some kind of existential pain, and psychologically it represents itself as pride, you know, ego, whatever. And the way to address that state is to accept Christ, sacrifice yourself, accept Christ. So we get to the point where we're happy, presumably then we do the right thing every time, or at least we don't have the pang of conscience of knowing that there is a right thing and not doing it. I don't know exactly, but presumably we would do the right thing every time. And we get over this thematic part of ourselves. So we, in some sense, there has to be an ego death that's associated with, and we become these happy, contented, presumably benign figures in the world. But we still have to deal with it every day. It's an active practice. And
I think the doing the right thing every time might be like the Confucian idea. Like you've internalized the forms. So it's not that you gain a new conscience that is specially plugged into Christ. It's just that you've studied the books and what Christ actually said. And so it becomes...
My question here is this. If from the outside, the Lewisian happy Christian cannot be differentiated from the enlightened Buddhist or the mature Stoic, then what do we need the Christ part for? If we go back, if ultimately the result practically is just that you're like any other enlightened person out of any other wisdom tradition, he went to all these great lengths to talk about why you need Christ.
He would disagree with it because of the community aspect of the connectedness to other human beings that is represented by the community on Christ as sons of God.
Yeah, I agree with that, but he doesn't put a ton of emphasis. Like he doesn't talk about it as much as I did.
Right. You sort of want a Q&A at the end of this where he like, okay, wait, are Hindus going to hell? Well, if insofar as they have something that is also giving them exposure to the same thing, you know, are they essentially, they couldn't have had their own Christ. He rules that out. But could they have independently historically worked up something that would get you to something like the same place? Again, in places where Christianity differs from Hinduism, Christianity's right, he's going to say. But that doesn't mean that the other traditions couldn't be very right about a lot of things and produce wonderful people.
I feel like on this kind of sectarian question, he finds things, his Anglican tradition, more convincing. But I basically take him at his mere Christianity kind of point of view, that he's interested in advocating and trying to be persuasive to people to act, I'll call it, in a Christian way, and to be an apologist for a Christian point of view. But he doesn't seem particularly interested in just even engaging that. It's just not the most pertinent and alive question and solution for him in Christianity that, oh, well, the Hindus are going to hell. I feel like that would be in a class like sort of the most boring arguments, the most boring points of contention within Christian traditions.
All right. I think there's a lot more room for us to freeform on this, but let's do it another day in the context of another reading. Next time, we're moving to some pragmatism. We're going to do another CS, Charles Sanders Peirce. Questions concerning certain faculties, some consequences of the four incapacities on a new list of categories. Those are all 1867 to 1868. So that's next time. you should reach out to us and tell us what you want to cover. Email us, pl@partiallyexaminedlife.com. You can comment on the blog post associated with this at partiallyexaminedlife.com or Patreon or wherever you're listening to this. You can reach out to us through Facebook or what I will continue to call Twitter or Instagram.
Also, I am doing seminars on these episodes once people have listened to them. So look for announcements to those. You can go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/seminars for more information about those seminars.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.